Okay, so, you know, as I did the previous talk, feel free to butt in with various questions.
Can we use that mythology? I'm sorry.
I will leave it to you to determine which ones, if
they are,
all are mythology. I mean, there is this one book down there that many of us trust. But I'm going to start off a little bit light, but I do want to make some points, and that is that evolution is treated unlike any other field in science, right? You can go into any bookstore and find dozens of books like this, written in a very authoritative manner by people who have put no effort into trying to understand the field and show no desire to. Pardon? And it's been an odd year this year in particular because, you know, this is the big 200th anniversary of Darwin year, and there's been Darwin festivals everywhere, and it's been pretty awful, actually, because often they're run by non-evolutionary biologists, philosophers, and so on, and, you know, the basic idea is that if you understand natural selection, which you can treat a first or second grader natural selection, that's all you need to understand to be an evolutionary biologist. So that's one point I'm trying to make. One of these books, so here's a quote that comes out, and I think this will be useful as provide a context for the rest of what I talk about. This is a direct quote from one of these books by I won't tell you which book, it's by a rather famous biologist. Most expositions of the evolutionary process have focused on microevolutionary mechanisms, so this is a pejorative, actually. This is not a good thing. Millions of biology students have been taught the view from population genetics that evolution is change in gene frequencies. Isn't that inspiring? This view forces the explanation towards mathematics and abstract descriptions of genes and away from butterflies and zebras. The evolution of form is the main drama of life's story, both as found in the fossil record and the diversity of living species. So let's teach that story. Instead of change in gene frequencies, let's define evolution as evolution of form as change in development. You know this. Wow. That's amazing. It's a quote that I'll never be able to forget, and I'll probably never be able to read a Sean Carroll book again after reading that. He's a great writer, really great writer. I had the pleasure of presenting this in front of Sean a couple of years ago at Irvine on a conference on complexity. I've highlighted these points in red because they do make a point. There's really a lot of mythology out there about evolution, and one thing I, of course, want to emphasize is that evolution isn't just a storytelling exercise. Evolutionary biologists are concerned with the mechanisms by which change has come about over time, not simply in documenting, doing comparative biology, and documenting differences among organisms, and we've been able to do that for many centuries. So this other criticism that about microevolution, especially in the field of evo-devo, and I do want to emphasize that a lot of this kind of orientation comes from people working on big multicellular organisms, and we tend to forget that 99.9% of the tree of life is unicellular. That's really where most of biodiversity is, not in multicellular lineages. We happen to be a multicellular lineage, so I guess we find our, you know, multicellular particularly interesting. But the argument often made by people in the field of evo-devo, evolutionary developmental biology, is that microevolutionary theory is incapable of explaining the kinds of changes that people have seen in terms of developmental differences between organisms. Simply can't explain the evolution of complex phenotypes. And so, of course, I'll argue that that's just bunk. And the point that I want to make is that evolution reflects changes in gene and genotype frequencies, more than one locus at the same time. And to my knowledge, there's not a single print observation in molecular cellular developmental biology that's overturned the rather substantial mathematical theory of the mechanisms of evolution that's been developed over the past 50 or 60 years. And then finally, population genetics is uninspiring. This one might actually be correct. But I also want to point out that the purpose of population genetics is not to be inspiring. Its purpose is to give us some explanatory power to understanding the mechanisms of evolution. Oh, and then what was this final one? Okay, this is another one that I think is important pointing out. It probably should be pointed out to a broader audience that will arrive next week, is that there's often this misconception if you're doing comparative biology, you're doing evolutionary biology. But you can't simply look at two rather different phenotypes. That tells you what evolution has produced. It doesn't tell you the mechanisms by which those changes came about. And that's what we're interested in the field of evolutionary biology, the actual population genetic mechanisms that give rise, starting from a common ancestor, to biodiversity that we see today. So I'm going to be focusing mainly here on genome evolution. It's what I work on, but I'm interested in seeing. I'm very interested in this series of workshops over the next few weeks to see what it might take to move the general principles that I'm going to be talking about here with respect to genome evolution up to the next higher level of organization, the cell. I mean, I find it a bit bizarre that we have a field of molecular evolution, pretty sophisticated, a field of genome evolution now, and some would argue we have a field of evolutionary developmental biology, and we just sort of skipped over the cell. There's no evolutionary cell biology, and part of, I think, the intention of this whole series of workshops over the next few weeks is to see if one might be developed. I mean, what would even be the questions in evolutionary cell biology? So as I say, I'll be focusing on genome evolution, but as I do, you know, think of the complexity at the level of gene structure that I'll be getting into is a metaphor for getting into the complexity of structure at the cellular level. So,
a question, sir? Oh, I'm just trying to understand exactly the point that you're making. So, 99.9, are unicellular organisms. So, for example, would evolution of bacteria and unicellular algae sort of satisfy you as a cell biology, or are we aiming, because we can also talk about the cell in a multicellular organism, which raises sort of another issue.
In fact, most of cell biology is done with cells in multicellular organisms. Most of cell biology is cancer biology, really.
So for example, you know, one obvious evolutionary issue there is how does benefit for its contribution to fitness get properly apportioned to a particular cells? That's the germline.
I'll return towards the end of some hypothetical questions that you might ask in cell biology from an evolutionary perspective.
I didn't formulate my question very well. But you're not happy with just studying evolution of prokaryotes because they don't have enough internal structure.
Oh, no, I'm not excluding prokaryotes at all.
He didn't say that.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand.
I thought he was criticizing the idea that multicellularity and interest were necessarily.
I mean, in fact, there are some prokaryotes that are multicellular, the myxobacteria, for example, that have several cell types. Cyanobacteria have several cell types.
Well, precisely. So we can, for example, sort of study evolution of cooperation and cell-cell communication. But I guess you don't really want to study cell-cell communications, right? Because that's not cell biology.
No,
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit, I don't know how you would define cell biology. If you go to a cell biology textbook, there's going to be chapters on cell-cell communication,
sure.
For sure.
I think you might be reading too much into it. I think he was just criticizing the evolution as being the only way of doing it.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, most evolutionary biologists do work on big multicellular things. So there's this intrinsic bias in the field of evolutionary biology towards multicellular organisms. But there's huge diversity among, so most lineages of, well, all prokaryotes and most eukaryotes are really unicellular. And it turns out there's just a huge diversity with respect to cell biology, and we just sort of touched on it with channels today, which I barely understand. But you know, you go to a general textbook in biology and you'll be taught this is how mitosis works. There's a huge range of variation in how mitosis operates among different phylogenetic lineages of eukaryotes. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And another issue is, you know, did the structure of the eukaryote, we tend to think of all, only in adaptive terms, we tend to think of all biodiversity being explainable only in terms of natural selection. Can we really be sure that the evolution of the eukaryotic cell, which is a real mess when you think about it, for many, you'll see with respect to genome evolution, did that really come about step-by-step process of natural selection, or were there other evolutionary forces involved? So I'd like to think that this could be done at the cellular level using comparative data. That's why I think we're hoping over the next couple weeks in each target session at least we'll be informed of the existing comparative data, so we would even know what the questions might be. So these next comments would apply to any area of evolutionary biology, but I view these as a minimum for getting a mechanistic understanding of how evolution occurs. First is that, as I've already emphasized, that evolution is a population genetic process. And so if we want to explain an observed difference between different organisms, for me it needs to be consistent with basic principles of population genetics, which I'll go through what these are in a few minutes. I mean, for me, it's just not a non-starter. If you can't show that hypothesis about divergence among diverse lineages is consistent with basic population genetic principles, then I would have a problem with that, since you know, we just don't have any alternative framework, and this framework has been very, very successful for a long time. And then this gets at sort of the heart of this meeting. I'm probably one of the few biologists who would say evolutionary biologists who would say that a minimum requirement for understanding evolution is understanding intracellular environment. But and we didn't used to have to do this in evolutionary biology. We would just, population genetics, we would just write down a set of equations for the frequency of allele big A and do it in terms of a selection coefficient and a mutation rate and a recombination rate, and that was it. We didn't have to worry about the biological details at the time because we didn't know what they were. But now we know an awful lot about cell biology. It's just like in community ecology. If you want to understand the ecology of a community of organisms, you need to understand all the interacting players, who interacts with who, and so on. And the same would be true in trying to understand the structural basis of evolutionary changes, knowing what goes on inside cells, which proteins actually ever get to see each other. You know, not based on a yeast 2 hybrid test to see if they'll actually talk to each other in that context, but whether they even see each other in a cell. I mean, you have to have that if two proteins are going to co-evolve over evolutionary time. This is the thing that we've done very well in evolutionary biology for a long time, and we've focused almost exclusively on the external environment, the challenges that the environment impose on the organism, and then phenotypic evolution follows from that. And surely natural selection based on the external environment has been exceedingly important, but as we'll see in the context of genome evolution, a lot of our understanding, our ability to understand comparative genome biology to a large extent rest on the idea that the power of natural selection has been greatly relaxed In other words, it's very difficult to understand genome evolution by just invoking natural selection. And a lot of what you'll see is much easier to explain due to the absence of natural selection. And that's one of the points that I want to make, is that even if you feel natural selection explains all of biodiversity, like in any other area of science, you need a null hypothesis. And this is where the storytelling comes in. If you're simple, to me, just making up a story about natural selection being the source of biodiversity is really not much different than intelligent design. It's just that the nature of the designer is slightly different. But this is, if you want to explain variation from the standpoint of natural selection, you ought to be able to reject the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis would be, what would we expect in the absence of natural selection? So, and that's what I'll be largely talking about, and we'll see that it's been a pretty successful enterprise in terms of understanding the evolution of genome architecture and the structure of eukaryotic genes. For those of you who aren't familiar with the huge amount of data now that are available from comparative genomics, this slide here simply, it's a very crude depiction of the number of genes in different organisms with rather dramatic cellular and intracellular organization. The bottom line here is that there's essentially no relationship between the complexity of an organism at the phenotypic level and the number of protein coding genes in that organism. So prokaryotes contain some there's a few that we know now that are down to 200 or 300 genes. So these are endosymbionts, however, that have lost a lot of genes. And there's some that are up to 7,000 genes. There's a lot of deeply branching unicellular lineages, so this is really hiding probably about 90% of all eukaryotic diversity here. But you can see here there are some unicellular eukaryotes. So I need to emphasize, you know, eukaryotic cells are absolute monsters compared to prokaryotic cells. We work on some endosymbiotic bacteria that live inside this guy here, Paramecium, and you could fit probably a million of those inside a typical eukaryotic cell. So eukaryotic cells really a large cell compared to prokaryote in general. And we do have eukaryotes, but much more complex cell. Nevertheless, we have eukaryotes that have smaller number of genes than we find in some prokaryotes. Now, the human genome, we still argue a bit about, but the human genome contains something on the order of about 22,000, 23,000 genes or so, protein coding genes. Most of us would like to think we're a more complex organism than this Paramecium here, single-celled Paramecium, which contains 45,000 protein coding genes. The pufferfish contains about 50,000 protein coding genes. Now, you know, that's a pretty sophisticated organism, but still, you get the point that I'm making. Daphnia is an organism we work on, a microcrustacean, 36,000 genes and so on. So there's really no order to morphological complexity or you know, behavioral complexity for that matter, and the number of genes carried within a genome. And yet, what I do want to emphasize, as we go from here, we're talking about genomes that are typically quite small, between a million and, in extreme cases, 10 million bases in the genome. Yep.
Is there any way to get out of this number? If you will take the same sentence and write it a million times, you don't give any new information. So, I mean, the question is, is there any way to quantify which portion of this number is actually relevant?
Which is the subset of the total gene count is what we should be comparing.
That subset has a relation, you know, to how complex it is.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know how you would draw the line. I get your point, though.
I don't know. That's why I was asking. Yeah. I don't know much about biology. I was asking if people are doing it.
No, it's a good point. And one thing I'll emphasize here, the reason this Paramecium has 45,000 genes is because about, we don't know the exact date, but somewhere in the order of 5 to 10 million years ago, its whole genome was duplicated. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you could say there's 22,500 genes that are just, it's not that simple, because some of the genes, duplicates, have evolved new functions and so on.
Can I ask the question?
And the pufferfish is a member of a fish lineage, duplicated the whole genome.
Can I ask a question slightly different way? Suppose that instead of looking at the total number of genes, you looked at the total number of genes which have certain types of annotations.
Yeah, people do this. There's this thing called gene ontology, but the vast majority of genes, we don't know what they do. So that would be a highly inaccurate count. And I guess one other point, it is a good point to raise. Another issue is that the total number of protein coding genes in an organism does not equal, at least in eukaryotic organisms, does not equal the total number of protein types. And I'll be talking about the evolution of introns soon, and the issue is that most eukaryotes have genes that are subdivided by introns, coding exons, non-coding introns, and what you can do with a single gene then is, in a certain tissue context, leave out a certain exon, and so on. So you can make what we call this alternative splicing. So by alternative splicing, you can make any number of different proteins out of a single gene. So that adds to just makes the problem of what should we be counting here all the more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Are all the champions in the gene count?
Are the champions up here?
Do all of them have duplications?
That's also a very hard question. I think you could, depending on how far you want to go back, I think you could argue that almost every organism has experienced a polyploidization event. You know, one of our workhorses in cell biology is yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Its genome is the product of an ancient duplication event, yeast. It's thought now, there's still debate, but it's thought that at the base of the vertebrate lineage, there was a genome duplication event. It's almost impossible to find, it probably is impossible to find any land plant that doesn't have 2 to 3 polyploidization is duplication of the whole genome in their background. And it could be that at the base of the Cambrian radiation where all the animal phyla arose, there was a genome duplication event.
I guess the question has to be rephrased as a recent duplication. So for example, does Daphnia have a recent duplication?
The Daphnia number there doesn't. So Daphnia is interesting. It's got about 36,000 genes. Drosophila has about 12. You know, Daphne doesn't look much more complex than a Drosophila. In fact, my Drosophila colleagues would say it's considerably less, but that's up for debate. But the Daphne expansion in gene number is not due to polyploidization. It's due to expansions of a large number of families. So you'll see a lot of genes with tandem duplicates. So instead of having one gene here, you might have 3 or 4 or 5. I don't think this is true, actually, the channel proteins in Daphnia. So what I meant to emphasize is that although there's no general gradient in the gene count here, what there is a tremendous gradient is the size of the overall genome. As I was saying, down here, no bigger than 10 million bases, but us big vertebrates, up to 3 to 5 billion bases in the genome. So genome expansion and going from here to here is not due to any general increase in gene number. It's due to an increase in the non-coding DNA in the genome. And one big question here is what's cause and what's effect? Do you need all that excess DNA to make a more complex organism, or is there something about more complex organisms that makes it easier for the genome to accumulate a lot of excess DNA, which has no beneficial function to the organism whatsoever? And I'll be arguing that that's the general case. Because what's going on from here to here is not just a simple change in the complexity of the organism. We'll see that every single rule in population genetics changes when we go from here to here. In particular, population sizes are dramatic, or many orders of magnitude smaller here than they are down here, and that alters the role of chance in evolution. So as I just said, what's going on? So these are plots of genome content with genome size and all these different groups of organisms that have been looked at and have a whole fully sequenced genome. The slide's a bit dated, but it's certainly the pattern's not going to change. So the way to read this is that for coding DNA, these are isoclines, so 1%, 10%, and 100%. And so what this is saying is that small organisms with small genomes, they're about 92 to 99% coding DNA, very little intergenic DNA. And then once you get up to us land plants and metazoans, things level off. The genome's growing, but it's not growing due to an increase in coding DNA. It's to an increase in the non-coding DNA. And what's I find really remarkable about these plots is that there's complete continuity of scaling of genome content with genome size across dramatically different groups of organisms. So here we have viral species, DNA-based viruses, and it merges smoothly right into prokaryotes, which is overlapping with these purple points here, which are unicellular eukaryotes. So there's no sudden discontinuity in the behavior of the scaling between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. And at least to me, that raises the possibility, at least, that the same general rules apply to genome evolution in prokaryotes as eukaryotes. It's just that we're residing on different ends of this continuum. So what's going on with the increase in genome size, then, is it's the intergenic DNA.
Sorry, prokaryotes, though, all of their DNA is coded.
92 to 99% typically, yeah.
Right, and so I guess I'm not sure.
There are a few exceptions.
Right, I'm not sure where the discontinuity would be. When you said that, I said, oh yeah, that's very interesting, but then I looked at it, it's like, that's the line y equals x, so, right, you know, it's,
Yeah, we've got a few prokaryotes now that are really bloated genomes that are somewhere up around here, and they're starting to level off. And just as these plots would predict, they're prokaryotes that are full of insertion elements. Okay. So.
But wait, sir, are you saying that it could have been that it would have leveled off at different points?
No. I'm simply arguing that there's, you could. And envision a world where viruses were down here or something, and then prokaryotes were up there.
But how did viruses be down there? Because that would mean that all of the viral DNA was not coded for it to be down there.
Right. I'm just making something up. Let's leave the viruses here and put prokaryotes here, and then a sudden jump down to eukaryotes. But there's no discontinuity in this scaling among these major.
It's also true that the prokaryotes have basically no non-coding DNA. So that's also, that's the reason why.
Right. Well, what I'm just saying, though, is there are some prokaryotes that we know now that have big bloated genomes. Now, when you go in and look at them, they are full of transposable elements.
It's rare.
It's rare, but I think it makes an important point, though. It means that prokaryotic genomes are not immune to the same kinds of genomic expansions that we experience if put in the right population genetic environment. So what you see then is there's this, so this is the 10% line. So most microbes have about 10% intergenic DNA. And then you see this sudden threshold behavior. So, that's the human genome out there. And you see the same kind of discontinuity for threshold behavior for intronic DNA. I'll be talking a lot about introns, so I'll leave this out, the details of what an intron is out for a few minutes. But the main point is that there's this threshold behavior in the intergenic, between gene, and intragenic, intronic DNA that you see in these different organisms. So these are just general principles, I think, the jury is in on this. This is the pattern of scaling of genome content with genome size across all of cellular and non-cellular life. So what we want to do then is to see if we can understand how these patterns have come about in terms of standard population genetic forces without invoking natural selection initially. Because remember, what we're trying to do is set up a null hypothesis. And what's turned out in the field of genome evolution is that it's been very difficult to reject the hypothesis that most of genome architecture and eukaryotic gene structure is due to differences in the, what I call the three non-adaptive forces of evolution. Now, it's not true that when I'm talking about there's no natural selection, because certainly a lethal allele is eliminated from the population, so at that level there clearly is selection. But all the nuances with respect to gene structure and genome architecture that I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to be arguing, have not been promoted by their adaptive characteristics. So I talk a lot about what I call the population genetic environment. And that consists of three of the major evolutionary forces. So one, mutation creates variation upon which natural selection operates, and evolution would not be able to move without mutation. No organism has figured out a way to stop mutations from happening, and I'll talk, give you some good data on that and scaling data on that as well. Recombination then allows organisms to reassort variation within and among genes in sexually reproducing organisms by standard meiotic recombination and so on. And then random genetic drift is a stochastic force in evolution due to the finite sampling of gametes in populations. So I guess for those of you not familiar with the concept of random genetic drift at all, just I guess the simplest way to think about it would be coin flipping, right? And you have an unbiased coin, and you flip it enough times, and you're going to get 50-50 heads and 50-50 tails. So think about that as an allele frequency, the head allele and the tail allele at some locus, okay? But if you only flip the coin a few times, it's going to, the frequency of heads and tails is going to, on average, it'll be 50-50 if you play the, you know, the coin flipping roll 10 times, many times over, the average of all those outcomes will still be 50-50. But in any one realization of the process, it'll deviate a lot from 50-50. And so that happens in evolution. Every generation, we roll the dice as we produce gametes for the next generation. And so drift plays a much more prominent role in small populations.
So should one be also thinking of, you're going to hate this word, I'm sure, evolvability as another element of a population genetic environment? I can imagine, you know, bacteria that have to fight antibiotics and are under different conditions than something which has found itself a nice stable niche. Maybe it's just not true that everybody is sort of suitably average over eons is under the same.
Oh, we're all under different selection pressures for sure. Yeah, you're right. I guess you actually, that was a loaded question. I think you know that I have problems with the term evolvability. A part of the problem is simply it doesn't have a precise definition. It's been used in bizarrely different ways
by different
individuals.
But nonetheless, maybe we have to sort of come up with a sensible definition of this term and actually elevate it into another dimension for that.
But the timing of your question is good, because what I want to emphasize now, you can call it evolvability, whatever you want, what I want to emphasize is all three of these major forces of evolution, we're all exposed to them. So it's a unifying feature of evolution, is these are the major forces of evolution. No organism has been able to stop them. Even prokaryotes that don't engage in meiotic sex still have recombination. At the level of nucleotide, it's almost as high as we humans have. They just do it in different ways. What I want to emphasize and demonstrate now with real data is how each one of these forces scales with genome size and organismal complexity. And so because each of these forces, they work together to determine how evolution proceeds, in a very loose sense, I'll go ahead and use the word, you know, evolvability in a crude way, or the way populations evolve, the paths by which, down which they can go, varies a lot depending on as we'll see, the size of the organism. So if there's one single law in ecology, it's illustrated here. And this has been seen over and over and over again. I can't tell you why this law is obeyed, but it the data here are from diverse organisms. So what we're looking at here is a plot. It's a log-log plot. The slope is minus one. We're looking at the population density of an organism as a function of the size of the organism. So the slope on a log-log plot being minus one, this means there's an inverse relationship, which means if you double the size of your organism, you reduce the population size by 50%. And you can see that here's data from microbial eukaryotes. The data points are sort of blocked out here. These are freshwater invertebrates, mammals, and so on.
The data points are in those little dashed boxes?
Yeah, that's where they would be confined to.
Just this is really true.
Well, this pattern has been known for a pretty long time.
Well, let me rephrase my question in a more simple way. I mean, people would like such plot to be true. So sometimes they select the data for which is true. This has been done.
I would say that no one would argue about this pattern. People, who might be biased on either side of that battle.
Well, for example, I can draw another line through microbial. It is a negative correlation.
It's a negative correlation. One thing worth emphasizing here, I mean, this is a log plot, right? So there's...
It's log base 10, by the way.
This is log base 10. So there's so one thing to emphasize right away is there's 20 log differences in the numbers of individuals. This doesn't even contain prokaryotic species, which are going to be up here. So there's on the order of maybe 22, 23 orders of magnitude differences, the numbers of individuals in different species.
There are two statements that this plot suggests. One is that there's a striking negative correlation. Mm-hmm. And now I think we all have experienced this. There are a lot more bacteria there. But then the question is this slope really minus one?
It's if you go into any one group, it's not much different than minus one. It's I could accept minus 0.9, minus 1.1, but it's very close to minus one. The main point I want to make is that if you increase the size of an organism, you decrease the number of individuals.
But it's density, so we're still talking about packing them, right?
Yeah, but I'm not gonna go through the details. I've talked about it before in my book, but if you add in issues of geographic range and so on, the same general pattern holds up. Okay, but you're right again.
Is there even a bad idea in experiments?
Well, Van Valen had this idea without any real mechanisms. Of course, what it implies is that if there's an inverse relationship, it means that every species, on average, commands the same amount of energy, biomass on the planet, on average. I keep getting interrupted for just let me interrupt the interruption just for a second. I do want to point out that there's a lot of scatter around here. Right, there's a two or three order of magnitude range of scatter around here. So, every species isn't exactly on the line by any means. But this is the big picture across all of life. Okay? I mean, if you just focused on a phylogenetically restricted microbial group, you might not even see the picture because they would, their range and body size would only be like that. You wouldn't be able to see the picture. It's only when you take this out to the full range of life or a good chunk of it that you see it. The main thing I want to emphasize, there's enormous differences in numbers of individuals in species. And us guys out here, therefore, are much more vulnerable to chance, random genetic drift in evolution than microbial species. So there's this general scaling of population size with organism size. There's also a general scaling of the recombination rate per physical distance in different organisms. So here are data again from, I've just color coded them into four major groups, and you can see that complete continuity in scaling across these groups. Again, it's a log-log plot. The slope is minus one. in this plot. These data, this is the recombination per kilobase in the genome, the amount of recombination per physical distance in the genome in organisms with different genome sizes. So what this is saying is you double the size of your genome, you reduce the amount of recombination per physical distance by 50%. This is bad news for evolution because in general, there are problems with low recombination rates. Recombination in general, there are some exceptions, but in general, recombination can facilitate the rate of adaptive evolution and reduce problems of deleterious mutation accumulation in populations. The way to think about this is if you have two nucleotides that are very, very tightly linked together, so there's never going to be any recombination, then there might be adaptive mutations arising at this site and other ones arising at this site, but natural selection can't operate on them independently of each other because they're physically tied together. You'd like to promote that adaptive mutation and then another one simultaneously arising, you know, at that site that might have arisen in somebody else. That can happen if you can bring them together by recombination. And similarly, deleterious mutations can interfere with natural selection's ability to eliminate them. Because suppose you have one chromosome with one deleterious mutation at that point and another chromosome with one there, the net effect is they're both the same. They're neutral with respect to each other. So recombination facilitates the rate of adaptive evolution. So why the slope of minus one? Well, these data come from high-density genetic maps. So they're from meiotic recombination maps. And there's a simple physical explanation for this minus one, this inverse behavior. And this is a fundamental constraint on the evolutionary process in eukaryotic organisms. So the constraint is that during meiosis, and anybody who's been looked at very carefully, there is typically just one crossover event per chromosome arm per meiotic cell division. It doesn't matter if you're a mammal, if you're a yeast cell, if you're a plasmodium. I can't tell you why, you know, why it's like this, but that's how meiosis works in all organisms. So what's going on here is that as organisms evolve larger genomes, it's typically not because they're adding more chromosomes. It's just because the average chromosome size is bigger. So if you double the length of your chromosome, and there's one crossover per meiotic division, you reduce the amount of recombination per physical distance by 50%. Simple as that.
So why not make more chromosomes?
That's a good, well, one reason is that there may be very weak selection for a that would be one way to increase your mutation rate, or sorry, your recombination rate, is to make more chromosomes. And in fact, there's about an order of magnitude range of variation here, right? The organisms that are down here, these are the organisms with small number of chromosomes. So these are probably Drosophilas, a couple of these. And the organisms up here tend to have more chromosomes. So if you take into account the total genome size and chromosome number, you're probably accounting for about 98% or so of the variation and recombination rates. That doesn't leave a whole lot of room for doing some interesting science on the evolution of the fine scale evolution of the recombination rate per se. Because there's only 98% of the variation is just due to the very physical structure of meiosis. It's really quite amazing. So to me, this sets a physical rule on how evolution can proceed. Now you can argue about, you can modify this by reproducing sexually more frequently and asexually at different frequencies, but that would be a way you might reduce the recombination rate by going many generations without sex, which some organisms like our Daphnia do. But you just can't crank it up anywhere along this continuum unless you break up your chromosomes into little tiny pieces.
Well, this is tangent from what you talked about, but if you have some related thing, maybe. I was asking from the previous slide, why is there no notion of fitness landscape? In your previous slide of this general...
Because I'm talking about the three non-adaptive forces of evolution. I view that evolution as being driven by four forces. Three of them are non-adaptive, that's what I'm focusing on, and the fourth one is natural selection. There's nothing really you can say about, you know, in the scaling sense about natural selection. I mean, we're all exposed to different selective forces. So all I'm trying to do to present you with now is, I think this is a framework for thinking about cellular evolution. These are essentially indelible constraints on the evolutionary process in different lineages.
So you're not going to show such a plot for adaptive?
I wouldn't know what would be this axis.
No, I have no idea.
But I am going to show you a third one on mutation rates, and we'll see that that also scales dramatically. So all three of the non-adaptive forces of evolution scale, have these nice, what we call allometric scaling with genome size. So this is bad news for us big things. Smaller number of individuals, less recombination. So we can say with respect to natural selection, it's going to be much less efficient out here than it is over here.
Okay. And there's also division time.
There's also cell division times. Is that what you? Yeah, I'll get into that in just a second with mutation.
So actually, can one put a number on sort of horizontal transfer in sort of prokaryotes?
In prokaryotes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any prokaryotes up here. I don't know. There have been attempts. There's quite a few good studies on horizontal transfer in prokaryotes, but the time scale, I think, is just not there for these studies. For us eukaryotes, there's a very tiny amount of horizontal transfer in the nuclear genome, but it's nothing to write home about.
Curious whether, you know, prokaryotes are falling.
Yeah, well, there are other ways to estimate the recombination rate in prokaryotic genomes. It's based on gene sequence data in many, many isolates, and you basically are looking for patterns of linkage equilibrium. And when that's done, the rate of recombination in a typical prokaryotic species is never as engaging in meiosis. They don't have meiosis. Nevertheless, the amount of recombination per base is about as high as what you'll find in a eukaryote. So that's not due to horizontal transfer. It's due to transfer among different cells. You know, they eat each other's DNA and so on. Things get incorporated. It's not conventional crossovers like we think about it. But most bacteria are really pretty highly recombining. We tend to think of them as clonal.
So does that statement violate the scaling, because they'll have smaller genome sizes?
Yeah, they'll have small. They'll be prokaryotes are going to be over here someplace. They're going to be probably up here someplace. There's only about 10 measurements like this, and they're very indirect, so I don't want to push it too hard. But I do want to emphasize that prokaryotes do have recombination. Okay, what about the mutation rate? My lab has been working on this for quite a few years. In the past year or two, we've been able to make a lot of progress. So I'll be able to show you something about what we know about mutation rates in different organisms. And one thing to emphasize right away is that, like any other trait in any organism, the mutation rate itself is subject to evolutionary change. I don't know. You could argue there's a couple of hundred genes in a typical eukaryotic genome involved in various aspects of damage repair, replication, fidelity, and so on. And all those genes are subject to being altered by mutation themselves. So the mutation rate is a mutable trait. And what I'm going to want to emphasize is that the problem here is the mutation rate, as we'll see, is a very tiny number. So natural selection's been able to move the mutation rate down to a very, very low number. But that means that the mutation rate itself is subject to pretty strong forces of genetic drift. Because the basic thing that's going on here is if the power of drift is stronger than the power of natural selection, natural selection can't do anything because drift is just moving, you know, it's a fog in the whole process. So once the mutation rate is driven down to a very, very, very low level, the amount of improvement you can get by a new mutation that improves replication fidelity is very, very tiny indeed. And that means that selection can't drive, it's impossible for selection to drive the mutation rate down to zero, even if it wanted to, because populations are finite. And the problem is going to be worse for us big things, where drift is a more powerful force. We expect the mutation rate to drift up to a higher level. Yeah, and I'll be showing that that's the case. And then I'll be getting into the structure of eukaryotic genes. And that's, when I get into the structure of eukaryotic genes, that's what I think it'd be good to start thinking about. This is a metaphor for the more complex structure of eukaryotic cells. So the way we measure mutation rates is illustrated here. We do these things called mutation accumulation experiments. They're really long, laborious, boring experiments, but they're very, very powerful. The problem with mutations is they're very, very rare events. They're needles in haystacks, and yet we need to find those needles to estimate the mutation rate. So we set up experiments that will enable us to concentrate large numbers of mutations in individuals at the time of our assay. And we're talking about just spontaneous mutations here. We're not adding mutagens or anything. So the way one of these experiments might be done is, this just happens to be Daphne, an organism we work on, and it reproduces, it's a diploid, reproduces clonally in the lab. So we'll take one mom, feed her really well, start 100 lines, and then every generation we do single progeny descent. We'll take one random kid from each mom and start the next generation. And we do that the next generation, the next generation. This means that the population size is effectively reduced to one individual. So we've eliminated the ability of natural selection to eliminate mutations. We capture essentially all mutations unless they're lethal or cause complete sterility. And, you know, people get hung up about that. Actually, complete lethals and complete steriles are very small segment of mutations, but in any event, they're irrelevant to the evolutionary process, right? They're complete dead ends. So we get everything else. And if you don't believe it, here's an example of some mutation accumulation lines from for Caenorhabditis elegans, the elegant nematode. That's what a C. elegans ought to look like. This is what a couple of our lines looked like after about 400 generations of mutation accumulation. So you can see this one's got a protruding vulva. This is where they normally send their eggs out. It's got a kinked tail. This is a aberrantly rotund nematode. It's not an elegant looking nematode, and so on. So you get bizarre phenotypes that would never make it in nature, but we pamper these things so much in the lab that, you know, we can get them through just about anything, as I said, as long as it's not lethal. Typically we'll run about 100 lines or so. Yeah. We do it blind. We will, with C. elegans, they'll be living on a plate and we'll have a grid. And the technician will be instructed to just, you know, put the plate down and take the worm closest to that spot on the plate.
Oh, really?
We don't, because there could be selection within the progeny of a given brood, so we have to be careful to minimize within brood selection. And then once it's in the next generation, it's by itself.
And
C. elegans, about 4-day generation time.
4-day?
Yeah. So Daphne is about 2 weeks. Well, the C. elegans experiment, we just started it, and then the problem is they're sort of addictive experiments. You can't stop once you're started because it just gets better and better. But eventually we pulled the plug on that experiment after 450 generations. And they're actually in many people's freezers. We've given these lines away and you can thaw the lines out. But
was that a PhD? Was it 4 years?
Well, it was a postdoc in my lab who more or less went insane. Her daughter went on to become a movie star, and she's extremely wealthy. And the postdoc has dropped out of science, unfortunately, but she's living very well.
So, is there sort of additional information on sort of counting the lethality rate?
Yeah, typically the best data come from flies, and about 1% of deleterious mutations in flies are lethals. So it's a pretty small segment.
However, if you now look at the progeny of your after 100 generation of this accumulation, do you get more lethals in the progeny of that?
Oh, has the mutation rate itself elevated? We haven't seen that yet.
So do you have, you're saying...
If a mutator allele, a replication fidelity locus, got hit with the mutation.
That's another possibility, but just lethality due to interactions, due to
epistasis, yeah. It's a good question. So you might expect an accelerated decline in fitness over time if cumulative mutations interact with what we call synergistic epistasis. You could also see that accelerated decline, though, if the mutation rate itself went up over time. It would be very difficult to discriminate. All I can tell you is in our experiments, we don't see accelerated rates of decrease in fitness. So makes it a little easier to respond to your question.
So how would you do that in your experiment? You would measure the number of...
We actually measure the fitness in these lines over time as well to add to the the pain and... Oh, and you can do the complete life table of C. elegans. You take each worm and record the number of eggs it produces every day until it dies. Okay, so... in the old days, we would take a random sample of genes from these lines. Piece.
By the probability of viability.
Yeah. Well, this contains viability and fecundity. So each line will actually look at a number of replicate progeny. So we've got.
If I understood your experiment, in each line, we pick one of the children that it makes.
But then when we measure fitness at that point, we will take a number of replicate progeny of that individual, so we get both the probability of survival to maturity and then the reproductive output. So the way we're doing this work these days, in the old days we used to do laborious PCR amplification of random components of the genome. Now we simply go into these lines and we sequence the entire genome. So we use either 454 complete genome sequencing or Illumina sequencing. I won't go into the details. I think most of you know it's possible to sequence whole genomes pretty quickly these days and fairly economically. And this enables that we sequence these lines to maybe 10 to 30x coverage, and then we compare the different lines and see they all started out the same. So if there's a mutation, you'll find one line that's got an A instead of a C there, and all the others have Cs, and so on. We've done this with quite a few organisms. We have a paper that just came out in Science on Rhabdopsis lines. We're working on Chlamydomonas right now. I don't have any data on that yet. We're just sequencing our Daphnia lines. Just finished doing this with Paramecium. I've done it with C. elegans, and we have a nice set of analyses on Saccharomyces, the yeast, as well. A lot of people have contributed to this work over the years. And this is the bottom line. This is how the mutation rate scales with genome size. So we're really focused primarily on cellular life, but I do want to emphasize for microbial DNA-based microbial genomes here, these are actually RNA viruses, bacteriophage, and then going into eubacteria and archaea, the two major groups of bacteria, there's an inverse relationship between genome size and the mutation rate. It's remarkable. The slope's essentially minus one Jan Drake actually pointed this out about 15 years ago for microbial species with a lot fewer data, and many of us were very skeptical of this. What Drake argued was that all microbial species have the same mutation rate per genome per cell division, right? And that follows from the slope of minus one. You double the genome size, you reduce the mutation rate per base by 50%. And it looks like Drake was right.
Why are there so few delts? You make delts, not the color delts.
It's just, these are all the data that exist.
But isn't it, the gray dots, it's a much easier experiment. The color dots, this is a heroic, but the gray dots, isn't that an easier experiment?
Well, they're viruses, so they're, you know, there aren't that many constructs that people have focused on. With, you know, you need certain kinds of constructs to do these kinds of experiments. But that, all I can say is these are the data that...
Have you chosen viruses?
Oh, no, not even... remotely.
So it might not be true.
No, I mean, you know, phage lambdas in there and so on. They're all your, you know, your favorite sort of lab rat organisms. So you have this negative scaling in unicellular organisms. Again, I'm pointing out that the basic rule, you know, the major features, forces of evolution change among organisms in a predictable way. Now, when you get into cellular life forms, so here's prokaryotes, unicellular species, yeast is in there. That's Drosophila, our C. elegans, Arabidopsis, mouse and human. You see that the scaling is the other way around. Mutation rate per generation increases with a slope, a scaling of about to 2/3 power, essentially, of genome size. And that's a very highly significant relationship. So on a per generation basis, us big things have higher mutation rates than these small things. Most mutations are deleterious, so again, this is a problem. Yeah, that's what I'll talk about right now.
Is that first slope, the negative one, is that to guide the eye, or is...
No, that's a regression. That's not including these RNA viruses.
Okay,
yeah, our RNA is much more mutable than DNA, and it's been long known that RNA viruses, you can see, are mutation rates that are off the chart. And this is 10 to the... This is, to give you an idea of what mutation rate is, this is the mutation rate per base per generation. So these numbers have to be multiplied by 10 to the minus 9. So yeast, the mutation rate per base is about 10 to the minus 9 per base per generation. That's what I'm saying before. They're very, very small numbers. For human, it's about 10 times higher. These guys, these RNA viruses, one in every 1,000 nucleotides in the genome mutates each replication, just completely off the charts.
Just fit the RNA, what's looking at?
Oh, yeah, I think this thing is a little bit dated, and there have been a couple other points added, and I think it is, in fact, not significantly different from minus one. I won't swear to it, but this is a single-stranded DNA virus, okay? So RNA would be just these guys.
Okay, so I want to know why there's a two-thirds.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer to the. It's seductive. It looks like 2/3, but I, you know, it is 2/3, but.
Do you want a mechanism?
Sure.
It's wrong.
The mechanism's wrong?
Yeah, so you know, it's like Bob. And all the mutations happen.
Yeah, it sounds like a surface to area thing. That's, you know, 2/3, right? I don't know. I'm not prepared to say that there's that kind of mechanism, but it's interesting. Okay, so here now just focusing on the the cellular life data. Why is the mutation rate per generation going up in organisms with larger genome size? Well, one simple answer is that this is the rate per generation. There's more cell divisions per generation. So obviously, these guys down here and all these unicellular species, one generation means one cell division. Nematodes, there's 10 germline cell divisions per generation. Fly, there's about 30. Arabidopsis, there's about 40. And in humans, it's about, it's anywhere from 50 to 400 or 500, depending on what sex you are and how old you are. So in the human population, almost all mutations come through males. So we have many more cell divisions in our germline. And old males are particularly dangerous because our germline continues to... Well, we're not that dangerous if we're no longer reproductive, but our germline just continues to turn over, where that's not true in the female germline. There's a set number of cell divisions. So you could argue that that's part of the story here, but that turns out not to be the only part of the story. Turns out that our very... The very machinery, molecular machinery that's used for replication fidelity and damage control has been incapacitated in us compared to other organisms. So again, I'm leading into this idea that things inside eukaryotic cells, especially cells of big multicellular species, there's stuff going on inside our cells that could be better. So very quick primer on replication fidelity. So we replicate our DNA with enzymes called DNA polymerases. And fortunately, most of our polymerases are pretty good at when they're rebuilding the next strand and bringing in the appropriate base to make a Watson-Crick pair. Okay, we'd be toast if that weren't the case. But they're not that good. It depends on what polymerase you're talking about, but about 1 in 10,000 times there's a base misincorporation at this point, which we'd be toast if we kept things at that level too, if every 1 in 10,000 bases each replication were mutated. Most of our polymerases then have a proofreading domain. Not all of our polymerases, but most of them have a proofreading domain. So if you get it wrong, this causes the polymerase to pause and look back, and it can often repair that. So the polymerase is a second round of defense against replication infidelity. But even the proofreading capacity isn't perfect in our polymerases, and so you'll just miss it sometimes. And then we have another set of enzymes called the mismatch repair pathway that can fix this bubble. And if that doesn't get fixed at that point, then natural selection has got to take over, or that's a fixed mutation that will remain in the population forevermore until it's eliminated by drifter selection. So there's been a lot of exquisite work on the performance of polymerases from different organisms. And we can look at those in the context of the mutation rate differences. So the bottom line here's the total polymerase error rate in these different organisms. The way this is typically done is you'll knock out mismatch repair, and then you look at what happens after replication. And mismatch repair can't change anything. And what you can see here is that the polymerase error rate is much, much lower in bacteria than it is in eukaryotes. So there really is a reason why people use TAC polymerase when they're doing their PCR reactions and they're not taking their polymerases from their neighbor's cat or something like that. And this improved fidelity is due to both a lower base misincorporation rate, that first step, and also due to better proofreading. So no matter how you look at it, prokaryotic polymerases are better at the biochemical level. And I want to, it looks sort of here like we're better, we vertebrates are better than yeast, but this is per replication, and keep in mind that we're multicellular, and so when accumulated over the whole lifespan, these plots would then look like this. Okay? So the argument here is that the enhanced power of genetic drift in us big multicellular things has prevented natural selection from keeping our polymerase enzymes as good as we'd like them to be. And I want to emphasize, even in bacteria, they're not as good as they could be. People have selected for so-called anti-mutators in E. coli, and you can even make a better, slightly better polymerase enzyme in E. coli.
So you're saying if you can pull out of this against population size, so you're saying population size check differences explain all the variation?
Well, I'm not saying I'm saying it's played a big role. I'm not necessarily saying it explains all the variation. There's so many sources of variation in, you know, experimental error, and these are taken from lots of different kinds of studies.
Still, you can put error bars. So consistent with the error bars that exist, there's no.
Yeah, the data are consistent with that.
Consistent with the idea that population size explains all the variation, but of course it may not.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it explains all the variation. This is biology, you know, and you never find anything that explains all the variation, but I would say it explains a significant
fraction. You can explain all the error
fraction.
Variation within error bars. The error bars.
Within the confines of the error bars, sure. Okay.
That's the best you can ever do.
Yeah.
So, I guess, is the glass half empty or half full here? So, one can view this as a statement that mutation is bad, and you want to select against it, and you basically keep it down as low as you can, select for, consistent with the sort of population, for a given population size. But you can also imagine that, I'm going to use the dreaded word, vulnerability, right? You know, if you don't mutate, you don't get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that under some circumstances, you know, you may actually want to operate at, we have more mutations to be able to select from, and then the effect, but then basically, if you want this random drift, you also want to go to small population size. So I say that both small population size and high mutation rate is consistent with the notion that you want to inject more randomness.
There's been a lot of work on so-called optimal mutation rates. And, you know, it works fairly well with a non-recombining genome, but I think I've got a slide coming up. If I can just go to 12:30, and probably people are going to want to eat, and I'm not sure what to do at that point. I'm definitely not going to be done, but... I'll address this point in a second with the evolution, the mutation rate, and the consequences of it. But again, I just pointed out the problem with our polymerase enzymes. Same story for mismatch repair. So what these results are is there are various ways. The mismatch repair pathway is somewhat complex, so there's like 7 or 8 ways you can knock it out in yeast. And then you can say, how much does the mutation rate go up when we knock out mismatch repair? Well, in yeast, it goes up about 25 or 30 fold. So that means that mismatch repair is getting all but, you know, 1 in 30, if I got that right. But the higher the number here, the better the enzyme is. And so in bacteria, it's more up around 60 or so, and we're somewhat intermediate, and we've knocked out mismatch repair in C. elegans and so on. So again, you get the same general feature, and you have to realize again, these should be moved down when you add in multiple cell divisions. So the same general pattern. The best way to look at mutation rate is, I'm going to skip over this slide. I think I've made the point that mutation rates are higher in eukaryotes and still higher in multicellular eukaryotes, and it's due to, in part, the incapacitation of the replication machinery. This is the problem with the evolution of the mutation rate. So suppose you get a mutant allele that elevates the mutation rate a little bit. That's going to create an associated selective disadvantage for that allele, because that mutator allele will cause the individuals carrying it to produce mutations somewhere else in the genome. The vast majority of mutations are deleterious. Now, the good news is that, well, they're deleterious, natural selection will eliminate from the population. But the problem is, each generation, some of these are being eliminated, and also by sex, because you're just segregating them out, but they're being recreated again by the next generation of mutation. So we can estimate the selective disadvantage of a mutator allele in a pretty simple way here. What will happen is that due to segregation of mutations on different chromosomes, a deleterious mutation that this mutator creates on another chromosome will only remain associated with it for two generations. Just by random segregation, it'll be off in some other individual that doesn't contain this. So the average association of a new mutation created by this is two generations. So we're thinking about now the net deleterious effect of a new mutator allele, and it's the product of three numbers. The first is simply the elevated rate of production of new mutations. The second is their average deleterious effect, and the average effect of mutations in every organism we and anybody has ever looked at is deleterious. Yeah, there are some beneficials produced, but they're very, very rare. But the net effect will be a decline in fitness, and then we multiply by two generations of association. And
all deleterious mutations need not be eliminated from the population, isn't that? I mean, there is a probability of fixation of...
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's what I'm arguing has happened to our polymerases, right? And in fact, they will be retained in populations if they're very extremely mildly deleterious, because they'll be overcome by drift. So that's really the point here. And the point that I'm making is this product, this would be the selective disadvantage of a mutator allele. If that selective disadvantage is really tiny, so this is exactly the point that I want to make, is selection won't be able to prevent the invasion of a mutator allele. And we know what these numbers are. Well, I mean, I've given you the two already, but we know from other work that the average effect of a deleterious mutation is less than a 1% reduction in fitness. That's the good news about deleterious mutations. I mean, every one of us in the room has got 100 to 200 new mutations that our parents didn't have. No question about that any longer. The good news is that they individually have very small effects. They're not lethals, okay? The whole genomic deleterious mutation rate's about one. So all of us carry about one deleterious mutation that our parents had. The other 99, I'll grant you, are probably neutral. So about one per generation. So now if you imagine just tweaking replication fidelity enzyme just slightly, the increase in the decrease in the genomic mutation rate is going to be a tiny fraction of this that's already there, maybe as tiny as 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 6, and that makes the product of all these numbers very, very tiny. So all I'm saying is this explains why it's easy for mutator alleles to accumulate in populations. Okay, I've gotten way, way behind. I'm not sure what to do here.
No, we can just continue in another... Yeah, either in afternoon or what we have the schedule on them.
Well, so the deal is tomorrow, what we're supposed to do, we're going to change what we're supposed to do right now. These are flexible. What we're supposed to do is we're supposed to do nuclear core tutorial
first day, and then we're supposed to have an ion channel reading group.
Instead of the ion channel reading
group.
Excellent. Okay, I love that.
Okay, let me, I've got maybe three more slides to show. And then we're at a convenient break point, and it'll be the advertisement for what I really wanted to get into that I really hope will sort of inspire some of you guys to think about how to connect this to cell biology. So what I've been arguing then is that the mutation rate goes up as the population size goes down. It's just a natural consequence of increased power of random genetic drift. And we can test this directly in the following way. I already gave you estimates of the mutation rate, really hard to come by, but now we have such data. But how do we get at the population sizes of these organisms in nature in which these mutation rates have evolved? That's a very difficult problem. But we can do it in an indirect way using population genetic methodology. So the way to think about this is think about a site in a genome, a nucleotide, that you're going to sequence in many, many independent isolates from nature. And let's just think about the amount of variation at that site. nucleotide heterozygosity. It's neutral because these provide very convenient markers, because only two evolutionary forces are going to govern how much variation is at that site. Each generation, so we start out with, we're comparing two genes, they're the same. And each generation, each one of those copies is mutating at rate U, and there's two of them, so 2U is the rate of introduction of heterozygosity, variation. That's the rate of input of new variation. And then by definition, what we call the genetic effect of population size is this quantity. This is the rate of loss of variation from a population per generation. For a diploid organism, it's 1/2N. So the important thing to realize here, N, the population size from our point of view in population genetics, it's not the total head count. It's what we call the genetic effect of population size. The total head count is good for ecology. But it doesn't work for genetics, because a large fraction of individuals is not even reproductive. They're not contributing genes to the next generation. It has nothing to do with genetics. So we have to have this more indirect measure. And this is the power of random genetic drift. Well, this is just an input-output problem. And this will eventually attain an equilibrium, at which the rate of input is balanced by the rate of output. And that equilibrium is nothing more than the ratio of the input to the output rate. And so we can then go out to nature, sequence a bunch of genes, look at the so-called silent sites, the amount of molecular heterozygosity. Its expected value is equal to this product, 4NU, the product of the effective population size times the mutation rate. And this is a summary of these data from a large number of genes in a wide variety of organisms. We humans are over here. So humans are the most molecularly depauperate species on the planet. We have very, very little nucleotide diversity in our genomes. We can all look at each other, recognize each other's uniqueness in many ways, but less than 1 in 1,000 of our nucleotides, if you compare any two chromosomes, are different. And then you get out into prokaryotes, and it can exceed 10% in some cases. Okay, so the good, and you can see that there's this gradient out here. So these values are getting higher as we move in this direction, despite the fact that U is actually getting lower. Remember, I just said the mutation rate out here for these guys is much lower than it is here. So we have these values of 4NU now. And we also have the estimated mutation rate from these organisms. So what we can do is to take these values of 4NU, factor out U, and now we know what the effective population size is. And if we do that and look at it with respect to mutation rate, there it is. So there's clearly an inverse relationship between the mutation rate and the effective population size of organisms. Okay? It's quite consistent with this argument I've been making, that drift is what's driving, limiting the degree to which you can reduce the mutation rate. What's quite remarkable is that the problem with comparative data like this is, once you've sampled, all the major lineages on Earth, until we find life on another planet, there's not a whole lot you can do to replicate the experiment.
Sorry, can I just ask, the error bars on these points are, just a very...
Yeah.
Is it big or small? It's...
Oh, I would say the error bars are going to be big, but the bottom line is
really
the regression is still there.
No, more there then. I just asked.
Yeah, there's going to be big error bars in both directions. So let me just hammer this home. There is an independent way to do this, and that is that all us eukaryotes have a separate genome in us, inside our mitochondria. And so you can do exactly the same thing with the mitochondrial DNA, and there's some data from a paper by Pigeonot and Adam Airwalker recently that had the data that enabled us to look at this. And I don't know that I would make too much about this curvilinearity of the scaling, but the bottom line is it's again a negative relationship. So out here we have mammals with relative, you know, rodents, relatively large population size. We expect relatively low per base mutation rates per generation, and then we big great apes are way up there.
So that's saying within, because this is all within one.
This is all.
It's within in one of your dots on the last plot. This is all.
Yeah, this is all just mammals.
It's just
mammals. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I've tried to emphasize up to now is that, yeah, the reason these data work is because these are from comparative sequence data, and there's a good fossil record for mammals, and so you got to be able to, if you're comparing mouse and rodent, you need to know roughly how many generations back to, you know, 42 million years or something like that. So you can only do this kind of thing.
Couldn't you do your experiment on the mitochondria?
You could. And we have, because it's just in there, right? When we sequence the genome, the mitochondria are in there. Yeah, the problem was with the mitochondria, they have elevated rates. The mutation rates in mitochondrial animals is 10 times higher than it is in the nuclear genome. But it's a tiny genome. There's only, you know, 10 to 13,000 bases in there. So there, it's not a big enough mutational target to capture many mutations in the experiments we do.
There's just too much noise.
There's too much noise, yeah. At this point.
So you have to increase the time of the PhD thesis to 40
years. Yeah, that's right. Or sequence a lot more lines, which is now the way we're thinking. These experiments just go on too long. Sequencing is getting much cheaper. You know, instead of doing 10 lines for, you know, 100 generations, you know, let's do 1,000 for 10 generations and sequence them all. It's remarkable that now the limiting factor in these experiments, even economically, is just setting up the pedigrees and things and keep maintaining those as opposed to the actual sequencing. Okay, so what I the take-home message here is that all the major forces of evolution scale in pretty reliably determined ways now that we know. So all organisms are exposed to these three major non-adaptive forces, but they take on very, very different values, and that determines what paths are open and not open to various kinds of evolutionary change. So whenever we come back to this, let me just talk about this for a couple minutes and we'll be done. I just want to get it in your heads. This is one of the big mysteries of evolutionary genomics, is the dramatic difference is in the structure of prokaryotic genes versus eukaryotic genes. And this is what I was saying. This could be used as a metaphor for thinking about cellular evolution. Just as in cellular evolution, prokaryotic cells are very simple. You can say the same thing about prokaryotic gene structure. So a prokaryotic genome looks, of course it doesn't come in colors like this or anything, but it roughly would look like this. This would be a pair of adjacent genes, continuous coding DNA, no intronic DNA separating the coding DNA from protein, very little intergenic DNA between the genes. Typically, very, very simple transcription binding sites, often no more than one or two. And for many genes, there aren't any because some prokaryotic genes are transcribed in polycistronic units. So this gene is transcribed along with this one, and you don't even need a separate transcription factor for it. So these are kind of like the Priuses of the genomic world, nice, sleek, elegant genomes. And then you get into us eukaryotes, especially as big multicellular things, and this is the, you know, epitome of unintelligent design. Our genes are subdivided. Our coding DNA is found in what we call exons, and this is subdivided by things we call introns, non-coding DNA. Our prokaryotes do not have these introns. Our genes have big upstream and downstream leader and trailing sequences that people call UTRs, untranslated regions. And we typically have very complex regulatory elements upstream and sometimes downstream of genes. So much, much more complex genes. Now the problem with this, you'll see arguments all the time in the literature why this kind of gene structure is good for us. You can alternatively splice this protein. So the problem with introns is that they are transcribed. Remember, this is the genomic DNA. A gene has to be transcribed into messenger RNA. That messenger RNA has to be pre-processed before it can go onto the ribosome. The problem with introns is they get transcribed along with the exonic DNA, and then they have to be spliced out in exactly the right spot. Otherwise, you'll get a frame shift in your mature messenger RNA. So, you can make the argument, well, introns are great because now you can alternatively splice and do tissue-specific expression of different alternative spliced forms and so on, and we organisms do this. But the problem here is that this kind of gene structure evolved before tissues evolved. We're now very confident this is the structure of the eukaryotic gene in the ancestral eukaryote, which was almost certainly unicellular. So these did not evolve for, introns did not evolve for tissue-specific expression. The problem I'm trying to point out here is, and we'll be discussing whenever we get back to this, is every one of these embellishments added to a eukaryotic gene makes it a larger target for deleterious mutations. The problem with introns is there are certain splice site signatures associated with each one of these. If you touch one of those, you're not going to be seen by the spliceosome. You're not going to be cut out. You're going to be a null allele. 5' UTRs, these are a big problem. The problem here is that eukaryotes initiate translation by a scanning mechanism. When the mRNA first meets the ribosome looks down and it looks for the first ATG, the first start codon. That's where it starts translating. The problem here is if you've got this big leader sequence on the front of your messenger RNA, it's a target for the potential production of a premature start codon. You're going to have a non-productive mRNA. So you can see you add these embellishments onto a gene and you magnify its vulnerability to other kinds of deleterious mutations, which a simple streamlined genome like this doesn't have.
These deleterious mutations, which are non-starter, if the protein question matters, they're lethal.
Well, not always, because you could have a slight change around here and just a fraction, X of transcripts will get spliced correctly and 1 minus X incorrectly, right? The spliceosome is never perfect, so it wouldn't have to completely. You could still have some good transcripts sneak through. So it doesn't have to completely obliterate. It's a probabilistic sort of thing.
It affects yield.
Yeah. And I'll get into that, some of that later. And then one other thing I want to emphasize is that, even if you have intergenic DNA that you think is completely inert, that's non-functional, that might even be shown to be non-functional if you could clip it out and the gene still functions perfectly. Well, a non-functional piece of DNA in the genome is not going to suffer from a loss of function mutation. So you might figure, well, that kind of excess DNA is no problem, other than maybe an energetic problem. But it is a problem from the standpoint of mutation because non-functional DNA, whereas it can't suffer from a loss of function mutation, it can suffer from a gain of function mutation. It can acquire a transcription factor binding site, for example, that causes it to turn on an inappropriate time during development or something. So all excess DNA is dangerous in some sense. The more complicated you want to make a gene, and even the sea of inert DNA around it, the more you are opening up yourself to problems with mutation. So the metaphor to maybe think about this with respect to cell biology is that, there's an analogy going on in terms of cellular architecture. Prokaryotic cells have not just streamlined genomes, but simple, very simple architectural cells. Us big multicellular, us eukaryotes have very complicated cell structure. How much of that alteration in internal cellular ultrastructure is a consequence of direct natural selection or a consequence of non-adaptive evolution. Just a final taste here. The nuclear membrane. Why do we have a nuclear membrane? Okay, and why don't prokaryotes? Well, we were talking yesterday with Jim. There's one group of prokaryotes that do have a nuclear membrane. We don't hear about this in our biology textbooks. The plankton mycetes have a nuclear an envelope around their DNA. So it can be. It's not like it can't be done in a prokaryote. Well, one thing you might, Eugene Koonin has argued, and I don't necessarily agree that the directionality is right, but Koonin has argued, and Bill Martin, that the nuclear envelope arose as a consequence of the origin of introns. So the argument here is that, okay, introns arise, they get transcribed, you've got to splice them out of there before your messenger RNA hits the ribosome. So you kind of got a sequester splicing from the ribosome, right? So he argued that the evolution of introns somehow forced the evolution of the nuclear membrane as a protective mechanism.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you believe it?
I don't know. Eugene believes it, and I think Bill believes it. Here's an alternative scenario, and let me know what you think. An alternative possibility is that, who knows why, but the nuclear membrane could have come first.
Yeah.
And then that would have made it easier for introns to colonize.
Yeah.
So the problem here is that all eukaryotes have a nuclear envelope, all eukaryotes have introns, therefore we infer the ancestral eukaryote had introns and nuclear envelope. So there's no way to really polarize, you know, which came first to my mind. I'm rather attracted to the idea that maybe the nuclear envelope evolved first, and that just made a more conducive environment for intron colonization. They weren't as harmful now as they would have been otherwise. Prokaryotes, you know, don't have that kind of luxury. Their DNA is, with the exception of plankton mycetes, their DNA is out there, you know, more exposed to the ribosome. So I just put that out as one example of a kind of internal aspect of cellular architecture that might be related to non-adaptive evolution, so that we're not spending, you know, the next 6 or 7 weeks just trying to figure out how every nuance of cellular architecture is driven by some form of selection, that there may be other mechanisms driving these sorts of things. And sorry, I kept you pretty late.
It's non-adaptive, but I guess I mean, not having a nuclear envelope and having introns seems really bad. It seems like a really bad idea. I mean, because
how does one make this sort of retrospection in science, right? How do we make it a science, right? We're trying to explain something, but you know, there may be more than one explanation. You know, how do we falsify whatever the conclusion of the discussion is?
Right, so the character of this last anecdote was completely different than the character of your plots. So the beauty of your plots was that, criticize them, but there was a lot of data on the plots.
Yeah.
So, from many different things. So it was sort of, that was science.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this was an anecdotal.
Well, the thing about the nuclear envelope I just threw out there is, in fact, we're talking about the nuclear envelope in another day or so. So it's something to think about, but in biology, we're all so used to trying to explain everything in terms of natural selection.
Right, right, right.
And I'm arguing that shouldn't be the first.
So but suppose we go beyond that. So maybe just to sort of pick up our work right and say, okay, so point taken, excellent. We don't care about things. I mean, unless we need to care. But still, how does one make anecdotes of the sort that you just said into more than an anecdote?
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you. Given if there's no possibility of getting at it from comparative data, There's no way of, I mean, normally you have comparative data, and there's been two changes on a tree, and you know, you see an ancestral state minus minus here, and then you know, a clade here plus minus, and then a clade growing out of there plus plus, you tend to be more comfortable thinking this guy came after this. But the problem with what is appearing now is that the eukaryotic cell that gave rise to all of us was a real screwed up monster. It had everything. It had introns. It had a nuclear envelope. It had linear chromosomes with telomeres on them, right? We all have telomeres. Anything that you can think of that with respect to the gene architecture of UTRs, it had UTRs, it had everything all at once. It didn't get them all at once, but the guy who had all of those was our most recent common ancestor. And so there's no way to polarize this. I mean, you can just speculate as long as you want, but there's no real way to my mind, there's a limit maybe to our ability to ever decipher the order of events here.
But could one just say...
So why is it that important, though, if so? So maybe it is not an important question to know what came first, the first envelope or first...
Yeah, well, if you're interested in the mechanisms of evolution, it would be important to know what's the driver and what's just the passive passenger here.
Only for this little thing, I mean, not necessarily for other things.
No, it's a good point, because it's one singular set of events. I mean, eukaryotes didn't evolve. We don't have the luxury of seeing eukaryotes evolve multiple times, right?
So speaking of mechanisms, now, if one sort of defines some notion of complexity as, again, sort of through interactions as a complex fitness landscape and having to go through some valley of neutral or deleterious changes before you can reap a great benefit of a complex structure, then having actually smaller population, higher drift, and high mutation rate will facilitate sort of tunneling through these things. So this is sort of consistent with...
So I view the origin of the eukaryotic cell as something, a very lucky survivor through a very, very difficult time when population sizes must have been very small. And what's interesting is, and we can't pinpoint the exact date of the origin of eukaryotes for sure, but it roughly coincides with one of the two most dramatic climatic changes on the Earth. There are these two things called snowball Earth episodes. One occurred about roughly 2 billion years ago. The Earth was frozen over for a period of 10 million years. Completely, the oceans were frozen over with an estimated 1 or 2 kilometers of ice for 10 million years. So regardless of who you were, this had to be a bleak place, right? And this could, it's a coincidence, but this could have been provided for microbes. There still would have been billions of billions of microbes. And so it could have provided many unique and mostly failing experiments. And then the ancestor of us all picked up all this weird stuff that normally...
years, which isn't that much time.
Look what Lenski has done in his E. coli experiments in just 10 years.
Obviously, it happens But I'm wondering, but there's this notion that eukaryotes are more complex than prokaryotes.
Yeah.
So can one actually put a number on that? Is there a sense in which, genetic interactions are more pervasive in...
I don't know.
This
is a prokaryote.
I'm going for something that one can actually you know, measured.
Yeah, I don't know. I should apologize for even using the word complexity. I hate to use it because it's a loaded.
I use the vulnerability. I use complexity.
I'm sure I probably used it inadvertently myself, and I have in the past. But you know, there's some prokaryotes. And we tend not to think of prokaryotes being like this, but this is a multicellular colonial prokaryote with cell-cell interactions. These are the myxobacteria. This is a fairly simple cyanobacteria, nice colonial form. This is an anabina nitrogen fixer. I mean, they have some dramatically different cell types. These are heterocysts. In which nitrogen fixation takes place. In an aerobic environment, they keep these cells anaerobic. And these are the akinetes, the reproductive structure. These are the planthomycetes that actually have a membrane around their nucleus. So almost every oddity that you can think about in eukaryotes, you can find in some prokaryote.
So do we have introns?
No prokaryote to this point has there's still a debate on this. You know, it goes back to this thing called the intron early late debate. Wally Gilbert was the big proponent of introns early, and he will still argue that prokaryotes had introns, and then they all lost them.
Really?
Yeah. Gilbert will argue that the reason introns were there to start with was for exon shuffling, that you wanted to make, you had, let's just call them cassettes or something, and introns would enable you to mix and match and make all your genes. And then the argument is that once you got all the proteins you could ever want, then the introns go away. It's not impossible, but every eukaryotic genome that we know of has introns, except one that's been, and we talked to Jim about this over lunch yesterday. There are these things called nucleomorphs that, it's kind of complex, but a nucleomorph is a remnant nuclear genome that came in when a unicellular organism engulfed a photosynthetic organism and uses that photosynthetic organism to photosynthesize because it brought in a chloroplast. But when you engulf that thing, you engulf it with its chloroplast, its mitochondria, and its nucleus. Okay, this is called secondary endosymbiosis. So photosynthesis has been regained in a number of lineages by an engulfment of a primary endosymbiont. But in almost all cases, the nuclear genome has been lost in the mitochondria. The only thing left is the chloroplast. But there are two lineages in which there's a tiny remnant of the nuclear genome left. That's called a nucleomorph. And they're down to like 200 or 300 genes. But in one of them, all the introns have been lost. So it just shows you that it could happen. And once all the introns are lost, you lose the spliceosomal machinery, which is a very complex machine of over 100 proteins. But if you have nothing to splice, you're just going to decay. Giardia, really debilitating eukaryotic microbe, has two introns in the whole genome that we know of, but it's maintaining that. So it's very close to the edge, but it's maintained a spliceosome apparently just to deal with the spliceosome consisting of maybe 100 proteins to splice the pre-mRNAs for just two proteins. So, sorry, I got sort of off track there, but...
So, may I make a suggestion? So, should we... that was great, by the way, we should clap. So, the question is, do you want to continue this tomorrow, or